sighed and crumpled.
"Died as he fell, probably,"
a Theban replies, nudging the nearby branch with a sandaled foot.
"Who are you?"
"Charon, and this is Lysis," says the older Theban, heavy set and strong with a square jaw, motioning to the young partner at his side. The youngster with him speaks up, quavering, as stepsons and Thebans gather closer around the corpse and Crit shoulders through with Stratton.
"We didn't do anything to him. It's not our fault."
Charon, the elder Theban, his hair shorn in mourning, is a man of at least 40. His partner is less than half his age, wild-eyed from the shock of unexpected loss, heaped upon abiding grief. Inexplicable death. Fortune's disfavor.
"All of mine, stand back," Charon says. "Give these men room."
The Thebans widened their circle, each staring at the sudden corpse. Crit kneels down, runs his hands over the dead man's head. Stratton does the same. They whisper. Crit cranes his neck.
"Biddler, it's Dion, Ares' partner. He took a bad blow to the head on the battle plain. You can feel the bump, big as my elbow. It took a while to finish him, that's all."
That's all. Nearly all the greater sacred band is here now, silent and grave. Stepsons next to Thebans united by the tragedy of Dion's body crumpled in the grass.
"We'll put him on the pyre,"
Nico murmurs. Once he's shoved through the crowd and come up on Tempest's right.
"Ares with the trainees. Getting supplies. I'll send someone to get him."
And even more quietly.
"Our new sacred banders will see what happens when one of ours goes to heaven. What is common, we must do."
Nico quotes what Tempest has taught him. "Now we'll have Dion, a real body for our funerary pyre, after all. Not just memories of the absent dead." So it goes that way. When the pyre is all made, the fire lit, and every Theban has cast a lock of hair, a piece of gear, a favorite treasure, and said his goodbyes to absent friends before the flames, roaring high in the dusk, as if to touch the sunset sky. Then Tempest steps up and says the words for his stepson, Dion, with Dion's grief-stricken partner, Ari, by his side. Nicodemus stands by the two of them, Stratton and Crit, and all the friends of this departing member of his sacred band are there as well. Everyone repeats,
"Joy to you, stepson, and everlasting glory."
Into the middle of the fire where the body lies comes the shade of a Barsis, slaughter priest, and takes Dion in his arms. The spirit of the dead stepson clings to Abarsus's neck. While the Theban sacred band pairs are awestruck and murmuring, Abarsus locks his eyes on Tempus and smiles a soft, sad smile.
"Life to you, beloved Riddler," says the shade, "and everlasting glory."
Abarsus looks from Tempus to Nico.
"Tempus, Nico, it is hard to battle anger, for whatever it wants, it pays from the soul. Let this fire consume your anger, and make of it an offering to the god."
And the flames take two shades, Abarsus and Dion, to heaven. As the pairs walk away in hushed silence to drink or game or prayer or duty, and the fire burns down and the stars come out, Nicodemus approaches Tempus where he consoles Ari, his grieving stepson, and others wait their turn. Tempus breaks away to join him. Some creature rustles in the grass and moves on, unseen.
"Commander, did Abarsus speak to you? I thought he did."
"He said, it is hard to battle anger, for whatever it wants, it pays from the soul. Did he not say it to you?"
This warning from the stepson's patron shade is one of Tempus's own sayings from his days as Heraclitus, before he left Ephesus, before the curse.
He did. I just wasn't sure I really heard it. Or that you heard it. Or that we both heard the same.
The god still loves us, Nico. Gods and men honor those who have fought in battle. Although not the only way to interpret this visit from Abarsis, at least it is one way, the time-honored way. Then they see the Theban, Charon, consoling all his friends, young and old, touching arms, squeezing shoulders, embracing the distraught, helping where he can as tears finally flow freely, now that the remnants of this band of brothers have time to grieve among themselves. 46 fighters, mourning their 254 lost brethren. It is critically important that the survivors not lose heart. In change is rest. As he had thought it long ago, he thinks it again. Perhaps healing can begin now. They have seen Tempus alive and well among them, a miracle in their terms. They have seen the shade who loves the stepsons take a soul to heaven. Now, if the gods allow, his Thebans can start to mend and rejoin the living.
End of chapter 6.
Chapter 7. Dreams of Gods and Glory.
Long spear thunking into flesh. Man staggering backward, impaled, groaning.
Nico is sweating when he wakes in his bed in sopping sheets, as tangled as his dream of the battle plane. It is hard to battle anger, for whatever it wants, it pays from the soul, said Abarsis from the flames. Whenever Abarsis appears, Nico has strange dreams. Nico is never at ease with dreams. Stays as far as he can from the dream lord's realm. Now Abarsis has come and chastised him, and the Riddler, for their anger. Nico was, is, and always will be, a weapon of the god, nothing more. But he dreams about Chironea too much. Enough. He picks at the scabs on his arms, reminders from the battle, first absently, then roughly, then pulls them off altogether. Let's start anew. He gets out his summer duty gear, worn linen and leather armor bossed with bronze, soft low boots, his belt with knife, throwing stars and service sword, helmet and shield. Stored nearby in another trunk are the cuirass, sword, shield, helm, and dirk, given him by Ascalon, regent of the Seventh Sphere, and Teleki of Dreams. The dream-forged panoply is far too much weaponry for Sanctuary, at least today. The trainees must be dealt with soon, and the Thebans. Time to unite the sacred band, Thebans, with his people. One unit, one heart, one swing through life, as he'd promised the Riddler they would do. Crit is cranky when Nico finds him, parchment and wax and stylus strewn across his desk in his dim and musty room.
Stealth, why don't you stay here and do all this, and I'll go take your duty.
Crit's eyes are bleary with weariness. Billeting 66 fighters for a long stay means renewing old contacts, provisioning, accounts, and more. He has a week of new beard. They were in the slaver's old house, where the offices once were and are again. Mold crawled across the ceiling. Ghosts lurked in every nook and cranny, debts unpaid of blood and pain from former times, and joy as well, if a man but looked for it, and glory, hard won, of a rarefied kind.
"We're doing well combining the troops," Nico offered. "But I promised Tempus I'd deal with trainees today. And the Thebans.
Still want to trade duty? No, no, that's fine. You go do that. And I'll make sure your mare has dinner in her stall when you get back.
Crit got up, wearing just a chiton and a work belt, and walked him to the door.
Can I put Ari with that Shamshi boy? Sham needs a partner. Ari's loss of Dion will be hard to mend. They were more than friends.
Bad time. Wrong question.
You don't need to remind me. I've lost two partners.
And will not lose another.
But I don't know what we've got there in Sham. Let's take those three trainees with us to the Street of Red Lanterns tomorrow night. If you'd like what you see, Crit, it's up to you.
Nico was careful not to overstep. Crit customarily assigned new partners after pairs were broken by death.
I'll go with you, but that isn't what I'm asking.
Crit wouldn't let it rest. Tempest's executive officer was all attention now that the real question of Shamshi's fitness to serve was broached.
Your three Bandaran boys went into town with stepson's money and orders, spent twice what they should, prowled the streets too long, and came back too late with too little. Stratton is not pleased. Sham's the eldest.
I know. I'm sorry. They'll do better.
Sham will.
In Crit's mind, as in Nico's, the three trainees were Nico's responsibility, and Shamshi, of the three, the most liable when things went wrong.
Your Bandaran boys need to be treated like the others, Nico. I can't manage the squadron this way, with Thebans needing one thing and Bandaran something else and stepsons outnumbered. All my senior pairs have problems about this posting as it is.
You mean Strat has problems? Here, where the pair has had troubles before.
You deal with the commander. I'll deal with Strat. That's not what's on the table.
They were standing face to face now, in the doorway where the sunlight slanted through under the overhang, bodies speaking volumes, opposed. They were about the same size and weight if push came to shove. Nico took a deep breath. Too much anger. When had they lost one another?
I heard Strat sent Sink and Gale down to the White Fold where that necromant of his used to live. You chase away your ghosts, I'll chase away mine, and we won't have a problem.
He struggled to blunt the edge in his voice. If you and Strat have troubles, or he does, like before, you come to me. I'll help, just among us three. The ghost horse was the band's keepsake from those days, an apt reminder of all that had happened here, and none of that could be allowed to happen again.
"What's Tempest really doing here?" Crit finally asked him.
"Ask him, not me." In the sunshine, behind the barracks, Nico found the Thebans out where Sink, the band's rangy horse tamer, was giving lessons in cavalry tactics, stepson style. Since that style was the most demanding and deadly yet devised, the Thebans were rapt, attentive, while one of their own fighters spun a warhorse in the ring so fast that horse and rider blurred.
"Sink, I need Karen,"
Nico called. Summoned, the heavy-set Karen came jogging, his young Lysis following along like a golden puppy at his heels. Both had spiky growths of new hair starting, just shadows on their skulls.
"Only you,"
said Nico to Karen, the apparent leader of the Thebans. The youngster looked as if he'd been slapped.
"Lysis is my son," said Karen,
as if that mattered. He wore a stepson-issue chiton, leggings because of the lessons underway, and boots. Nico stared until the youth backed up, all the way to the fence. "How are your fighters, Karen?" Nico set off for the altar on the hill. Karen followed, then came abreast.
"As well as any man would be, ripped away from everything they know and love, with all their brothers dead at Chironea.
The play of veins across the Theban's big hands caught Nico's attention, rough-hewn, weathered and strong.
They are your fighters, aren't they?
They are harmonies, or they were.
The older man was muscled and still vital. He watched the ground as they climbed.
Perhaps they're yours now, Nicodemus, or your riddlers, or your gods. But you speak for them.
I'm the oldest, the most senior. It means nothing now.
It means everything. Your judgment is unquestioned by your fighters. They follow your lead. You know their hearts. So help us save what can be saved and what can be carried forward.
They had nearly reached the hilltop where the black char was, where the shade of Abarsus had appeared to all the gathered sacred band, stepsons and Thebans alike. Charon looked at him obliquely, then faced him.
"Help you how, when everything here is so different? They ask me who and what you are, you stepsons."
"Help us make the two bands one.
As for who and what we are, what you saw on the battle plain is what we are. The sacred band of stepsons.
Does this storm god of yours really speak to your commander? Appear like the spirit in the flames? Will that shade of yours take our fallen up to Elysian from your pyres in their turn? Or somewhere else?"
"If Tempest says the storm god speaks to him, then it is so. When Enlil appears, it's in a storm. As for your dead and what power will take their souls or where, I don't know. Abarsus has always taken every soul of our sacred band to heaven, no matter where our slain fighters come from, or what god they love, if any." An eagle circled overhead, hunting. Its shadow fell over him, then moved on, right to left. Nico shivered. A good omen for what was said here, but there was no use trying to explain Mott to this Theban. Not yet. Perhaps not ever.
"Are we hostages? Conscripts? Our goddess, Harmony, is she here with us?"
Charon's craggy face worked.
"You aren't hostages, not conscripts. Go or stay, but with all your hearts. As for your goddess, only you know if she is here with you."
"Do you expect us to swear allegiance to your storm god? Serve him? Serve you? What happens if we don't?"
Very carefully, Nico trod this ground.
"My commander has been a favorite of one storm god or another for a very long time. We fighters are sworn to our commander, to the stepsons, the greater sacred band, to one another, to our partners, not to a god or place. What we hold sacred is honor, justice, and glory. You need not swear allegiance to our storm god to serve with us. Fighters are among us from many lands, with many gods and many beliefs. Believe as you will. What is between a man and his god is theirs alone to say."
It was so risky. Not what the Riddler wanted, who'd already risked so much and paid so much for these men. Paid even a stepson's life, to let these Thebans think they could walk away.
"As for serving us and what happens if you don't, what do you imagine was agreed on that Kyrenian battle plain? Your commander and mine came to terms."
Nico sought Charon's guarded eyes.
"We kept our bargain. You all live, you Thebans, you fated dead. And a stepson gave his life for it, so you can remember. So you can fight on other days. So you can fight beside us, equal and among us. Our word is binding."
Then they stood silent before the burned-out pyre, where nothing remained but a few charred and ruined trinkets. A hilt, a broken
blade half-melted, a female statuette or two. Karen gazed into the ashes of the pyre, unspeaking, blinking hard. Nico sent his senses questing. This Karen's spirit was turbulent, dark with loss, purple like the cuts and bruises on his arms and under his eyes. So much bloodshed, so much anguish, so little time to heal. Beyond the altar, a doe and a spotted fawn looked up, saw them, and leaped away. Karen said slowly, "In this new world, this day and forever, then, we are not only Thebans. We are all stepsons. We are all one sacred band. If you will have us, and mine will fight by yours, henceforth as brothers." Karen raised his head and extended his hand. Forever. Karen didn't realize how true that might come to be. Nico clasped hands with the other man, embraced him, stepped back, and said, "To the death, shoulder to shoulder, with honor. That's still the same, and always will be. Life to you, stepson, and everlasting glory. And to you, Nicodemus, my new brother." The words were thick, coming out in that strange, lilting accent. Words sometimes difficult to decipher, secured at such great cost across a sea of time and grief. So it was not over. With a goddess who might or might not be here in the mix, trying to come to terms with their jealous war god. Nico could not guess what would be in heaven, but in sanctuary things were finally well begun. At last he had something to tell the Riddler that might help to heal him. And he had something to tell Eri, that Eri's dead partner Dion had not sacrificed in vain, but shown these Thebans how to climb to heaven. And he had 46 Theban fighters to swear into the service of the Riddler, into his sacred band of stepsons. Disciplining the Bandaran trainees would have to wait. The sacred band ceremonies were going to take all day long. When the rites were done and the Thebans no longer a group apart, but sworn to the commander, the stepsons, and greater sacred band, the Riddler decreed a feast for that evening. So Nico, with Crit and Stratton, scrambled to attend to preparations. 4 lambs and 4 pigs and a steer were secured and butchered, and fire pits were built on a spot near the copse. Wine and beer were brought in from the town, and fruit and sweets and all manner of delights. The meat was turned on spits above the fire, and the men came up as they would. No celebration had ever been held at the stepson's barracks, so there were not tables enough or benches enough or cups or plates enough for all. Fighters ate sitting on the ground in the cool, tender grass from boards in their laps or held food in their fingers or sawed chunks of juicy meat off the carcasses with their knives. The smoke smelled sweet, mixed with wafting jasmine. Somewhere peacocks cried like babies, nightingales sang, and crickets chirped. It seemed to Nico like a night of triumph on a long campaign, like a camp after battle with torches lit and flickering all around and men swapping songs and stories, arms over one another's shoulders or standing about in little groups gazing at the fire in the dark. And in a way, it was. Crit came over, with Strat and the Riddler himself, while Nico was trying to talk to Eri. Nico had met Eri and Tysi long ago and reminded him of the night they scuffled outside an inn there, below the town. Eri was saying,
"I'll never forget riding away with you, Stealth, after you took down those Rankins with throwing stars. I thought we'd die there, quarrels in our backs, you for what you did and me for bearing witness."
Near the fire,
two young raccoons sat on fence posts, feasting on moths drawn to the light.
Crit, who had fought beside Ari in the Wizard Wars, said, "Of all the Tythians who joined us, you always were the best tactician, Ari. So it must have been one tough night, if you say so."
"I say so," said the bereft sacred bander, and then subsided, staring past them at the feast. Beyond him, Strat and the Riddler conferred, huge in the fire-lit dark.
Nico knew where Crit was leading things. Crit was intent on partnering Ari with Shamshi.
Nico put his food aside and got up.
"We're going into town tomorrow night to Aphrodisia House, Ari. Come if you like. We're taking those trainees of mine to see if there might be men hiding in those boys."
And he left Ari with Crit, who was pushing things too fast, Nico thought. Ari's partner was barely departed, a new spirit finding its place in heaven. But in the end, on the following evening, they all rode out together to the Street of Red Lanterns, Nico and Tempest, Strat and Crit and Ari, with the three intimidated trainees bringing up the rear on young horses from the string that needed night seasoning. Bats flew by, beating the air and spooking the trainees' mounts, but no one was unhorsed. When they got to Aphrodisia House, Nico still hadn't had a chance to speak with Tempest alone about Sham and the other trainees and the Thebans. So when the others went up the stairs, Nico held back, seeing to his green horse. Tempest came up behind him so quietly he didn't hear the footsteps over the stamping and blowing of their mounts.
"What, Stealth?"
He jumped, then turned, embarrassed at being startled, snuck up on like a drunken youth. So he spoke boldly. "Crit wants to pair Ari with Sham. I don't think so."
"Why not?"
On either side of Aphrodisia House's door, torches whapped in the night, throwing shadows masking the Riddler's expression.
"For Ari's sake or Sham's? Or does your Mott say no?" "Not a good start to this," from Tempest's tone.
"Maybe for Mott's sake, maybe it's just too soon."
It was only instinct, if a strong one, that Sham was a problem. But Nico had bigger problems, he thought.
"Commander, how do you... that is, are you pleased with the Thebans? Will they help us, do you think? Is the Storm God pleased? Do you feel..."
His concerns were intrusive beyond his station.
"Will the God forgive us now? Let you heal as you have always healed before?"
He couldn't ask, didn't dare. His commander's injury was his fault.
"Better."
Tempest's armored eyes showing no hint of what lay behind them. The Riddler touched him on the shoulder briefly, just a pat.
"Let's see what these boys are made of."
So up they went, into the brothel, late in the evening with the night all around and so many memories from time gone by, flooding Nico's brain and chilling his heart.
End of chapter 7.
Chapter 8. God-Given Right.
"I can't believe we're really here, Hawk," whispered Giscaris to Arten.
He was looking around at the clientele, at the girls at the bar, at more girls seductively lounging on burgundy chairs and couches in the brothel's ground-floor salon.
"And here with them!"
Chorus gestured over his shoulder at the Riddler and his right-side partner, Stealth, coming in the door during the second watch of the night in light mantles with weapons underneath, as if they owned the place. Arten couldn't believe it either from the look on his face. Sham had a different look, calculatingly perfect where he stood close to Ari, the bereaved sacred bander with his curly black hair, black eyes, and blacker spirits. Kouris watched the senior stepsons as closely as he could, these sons of the armies. How did they command the room without speaking? How did they make people give way before them? These heroes, seasoned and formidable, controlled everyone and everything in the salon as if by God-given right. Fox, called Critias, and Ace, called Stratton, made a quick circuit of the ground floor, inspecting everything, professionally unobtrusive, and nodded once. Then Fox and Stealth, attentive, honed sharp and economical like panthers are, lean muscle rippling, cleared places for the group at the bar. Next, Ace and the Riddler stepped up to the bar, dominating all the space around them, solid as city walls, and towering nearly as large, making everyone else seem smaller. Lesser men already in the room quietly left it. Women sidled toward the stairs until the buxom madam shooed the girls back in, to be appraised and apportioned. Then a girl came downstairs and Kouris couldn't hear or see anything else but the pad of her bare feet and the rustle of her sky-blue dress, with copper beads weighing down its hem. The beads tinkled, and the girl, her brown hair curling at her throat, moved through the room as if she floated on a cloud. Around her was an opalescent glow. Kouris forgot about the sacred band, about Artan and Artan's newly discovered mother, about everything but this girl who must pass by him to get to the couches, where the other harlots already posed provocatively. He was just about to go claim her when Sham stepped into her path, bold as a grown man. Kouris didn't know why, but rage filled him. Now everything becomes preternaturally clear. He sees the stepsons at the bar talking to the madam. He sees the girl's eyes dart around the room, and he sees Sham holding out his hand to her. And then he is there, somehow interceding, putting his body between Sham and the girl. Her blue eyes look up at him, doubtful and concerned. He hears himself say, "You're mine tonight." Sham behind him says something he doesn't catch and touches his arm. He shakes off the touch irritably, not bothering to turn to face the intrusion. The girl hasn't said a word. Now she does.
"I'm Shami."
"I'm Kouris." Over her shoulder he sees the Riddler and Stealth, elbows on the bar at their backs, watching him closely, their heads together. He felt a hand on his shoulder, Sham's. He heard Stratton say, "There's plenty for all, no fighting, rules of the house." The touch on his shoulder went away. He could hear Stratton and Sham moving off. Then his fingers grasped her wrist and he couldn't even feel the floor beneath his feet. The next thing he knew, the most beautiful girl in the world was leading him up the stairs, and no one seemed to mind a bit. Artan stood transfixed by the murals on the bordello's walls, depicting things he'd never thought about, and some things he'd thought about too much. What would his newfound mother, Illyra, say if she could see him now? The murals were a guidebook of what to do and how to do it. This was how he'd been begotten. There was nothing wrong in it. But some of what was painted here in bright colors behind the couches and divans was not gentle or kind. Some were things he'd never thought could be done among women and men.
"Have a drink, warfighter?"
said a voice beside him in the middle of the room. The woman standing there, her breasts pushed up nearly to her chin, was old enough to be his mother, and smelled moist like soiled sheets.
"Come along, take a seat."
Miserably, he followed until they reached a round table with three girls seated there. Then he realized this old lady didn't aim to claim him. The three girls giggled, rubbing their arms, showing their legs.
"What to drink?"
asked the old serving woman. He didn't know what to say, so he said, "Whatever they're having." He slid into a seat between two of them. They were rolling up leaves sprinkled with powder and lighting the leafy tubes from the table's candle.
"Here, warfighter,"
said the closest girl, a sharp-faced blonde.
"Smoke some. Like this,"
she demonstrated. He did. Colors sharpened, his pulse slowed. When he could breathe again, exhaling, he saw the entire Sacred Band leadership leaning on the bar and watching all with obvious amusement that he wished he shared. Wine came in four goblets. Each girl got one, and so did he. He drank fast, hoping for courage. The sharp-faced girl said,
"You have to pick one of us, fighter."
Her red-haired friend smirked, "Or take all three upstairs." A girl with light brown curls, so like his mother's, interceded.
"Or choose another," she said,
kindly waving her hand at the couches nearby.
"Anybody here?
Even the all-night girls, the famous ones." Her voice was wistful. Her dress was green.
"The madam says anything you boys want, you get. Anything."
This girl's brown eyes were exotic, dusted with gold. She couldn't be much older than he was. Her mouth was ripe under its red paint, her cheeks flushed. Other girls on couches preened and stretched provocatively as Ari and Sham walked by. Sham said, "Looks like you've got a bed full," as he passed and pulled on a lock of Artan's hair. The redhead at Artan's table tapped ash into the candle's pool of wax, her eyes flickering to the big fighters at the bar.
"Come on, stepson. Smoke's on the house, so's the wine, so are we. Make your choice.
Your bosses are waiting for you three to pick someone before they will." All three women looked at him like cats cornering a mouse. Desperately, Artan said to the kind girl with the brown curls,
"If you'd like, we could..."
"What did you say, propositioning a harlot? How did you ask a girl to go upstairs?" Then his foresight blasted him, blinding him to the here and now. He saw a brown-curled girl lying in a watery ditch, her white skin bruised and muddy. As quickly as it came, the vision was gone. If he took her up the stairs, was that the result? Or if he didn't? All three were watching him, and so were the stepsons at the bar. He said, "Please come with me," in a quavering voice, formally holding out his hand to the brown-curled girl. Her skin was white again, not covered with mud and bruises like the skin of the girl in his inner sight. She gave a happy giggle, grasping his hand. Up they went, past the bar, past Nicodemus and Tempest, wreathed in blue smoke, staring frankly after them. There were so many stairs. Her scent was heady. His palms were sweating. Her hips were switching, muscles moving provocatively under the thin silk. His blood was thudding in his ears. Here were more doors than stairs, door after door after door. Then she tugged him to and through one and pulled him toward a huge low bed with a bronze mirror on the opposite wall. She let go of his hand to smooth the ruddy velvet bedclothes. He had to say it.
"I don't want to do anything. I want to talk, just talk, for now."
She stopped. She turned to him, her hands already at the laces on her dress.
"What's wrong? Did I do something wrong?"
Her face crumpled. He was afraid she was going to cry. There was no place to sit but on the bed, except one wooden chair. How could he tell her? Could he tell her? He hadn't been able to tell his mother that he could see the future.
He remembered Illyra's face, wrinkled from all the life she'd led, how guarded she had been when she regained consciousness in his arms. She couldn't see him, his mother had said. She never could. His fate was hidden from her. And then she'd hung on him and wept and wept and wept, telling him there was nothing she could do. There'd never been anything she could do to help him. All of this transpired while Corus and Sham stood around in the little shop's front room, hearing every word. He wasn't going to be that way. His life wouldn't turn out that way. He wasn't going to let his bit of talent break him, fill him with fear and helplessness, undermine his nerve and imperil his future. He was a stepson, a Bandaran initiate. He could get out of destiny's way, bring fortune to heal. He knew he could. Someday. Eventually. Foresight. His gift and curse. He must make it serve him. Make it be what he wanted it to be, starting today. Or he'd end up like his mother, paralyzed with fear, plagued by prescience, bowed by the weight of knowing too much and not being able to change anything. So he sat on the girl's bed and patted the velvet beside him. Sit here. What's your name? He wouldn't let his foresight be the end of her, if her end was what he'd seen. She wasn't yet dead in his vision. He knew quite well, after Chironea, what death looked like. Where are you from? How did you come to be here?
Tifita, she replied. My name is Tifita. I'm from Azahur. My parents moved here when I was 3.
His mother would want him to do the best he could for this girl whose life was at risk. Somehow. So he began trying very hard to have another vision. See a better future for this girl, Tifita. A safe direction, a path to take this innocent out of harm's way. The more he tried to see a different fate, the less the girl in his vision looked like Tifita. But he couldn't banish from his inner sight entirely that vision of a brown-curled girl dying in the mud. So still, so sad, so clear.
Sham's brown-haired girl was already writhing under him when lightning seared the sky and thunder shook the whorehouse. His harlot squealed. 3 more lightning bolts split the dark outside the window, and cracks of thunder followed so close they seemed right overhead. Corus was having a good time down the hall. The girl under him froze, tensing to flee like a terrified dog seeking shelter from the storm. He grabbed her wrists.
"Don't mind that. It's just Corus finishing up, I bet."
No rain followed. No lightning flashed again or thunder rolled across the sky.
"Stay still."
But the brown-haired whore wouldn't stay still, and he liked it that she struggled under him. He liked holding her little wrists. He pulled them above her head and got both her wrists in one hand.
"Better."
She wriggled under him.
"Definitely better."
He shifted his weight, thrust one knee between her legs, and slapped her hard across the face. Her head snapped to the right. Brown hair fell across her eyes, across the pillow.
"I said stay still,"
she mewled. A drop of blood formed at the corner of her mouth, trying to drip down her chin. Red blood against white skin. Her breasts heaved under him. Her breath came faster and faster. He put his knee harder into the slick between her thighs. She arched up, her head still turned away.
Was she hysterical, really struggling, or playing at it? He didn't know.
But he wanted her feelings to be real, not a game, not just a drama bought and paid for by the stepsons. It mustn't be a game for her. He was about to make everything very real for her, unforgettable. She was sweating now, trembling. He got his knee out from between her legs and thrust himself down hard. He put all his force into her, pulling her wrists up and up, moving her as he wished with his body's strength. She moaned and quaked more as he got his other hand under her spine at the waist and bent her back, forcing his way where he wanted to go. He wouldn't let it be a game for her.
and then something in him roused to wakefulness. His mind reached for hers, caught hers. He tested her fear and fed it with not just his body's strength, but with his mind's strength. Perhaps she thought he was just a boy. Perhaps she respected only the money she'd been paid for this. He sent her mind to Chironea, where bodies lay bleeding and broken, heaped one upon the other, close enough to hell, that vision was, full of purple haze and swollen bodies, long spears thunking into flesh, men staggering backward, impaled, moaning. She started to weep real tears, then sob so that her whole body shook. He had found a way to reach her, after all. He tried something more, entranced by his new skill he was just learning. He envisioned her dying, pictured her lying in a ditch covered with mud, naked, dirty water between her legs. She spasmed. She struggled hard, throwing herself left then right, trying to find life amid the death his mind promised her. Then everything exploded into a rage he couldn't control, and he dimly heard her wailing. Eventually he regained control. Of her. Of himself. He didn't know how long it had taken. He was sure someone would be pounding on the door by now. He let go of her wrists and stoppered her mouth. She slapped at his back and scratched him, but not hard enough to matter. Then she gave up, lying as still as the dead under him, still as still could be, breath rasping and her eyes huge. One more time, he reached into her mind, and this time he let her taste the grave. She whimpered, afraid to move. Her fear took him over passion's edge, and he was done. Spent. She was no longer interesting. He let her go and rolled away, breathing deeply. She didn't move. The scratches she'd clawed in his back were stinging. He hunted for his clothes, his weapons. Lucky for her, he hadn't thought of those before. She took shuddering, greedy breaths. Fortunately for her, he hadn't thought to tease her with a blade. But he didn't really need one. His mind could do a better job. His talent knew just where to pierce her. He didn't like her now, at all. Though earlier, he'd thought she was the best of the whores available. Still no one came pounding on the door to rescue her. She'd made enough noise to wake the dead. He said harshly, "Isn't somebody going to come up here after all your screeching and squealing?" He still didn't know her name. "When Tempest's men are here, ha! Cries of pleasure and shrieks of pain, who can tell the difference? If you're done, just go downstairs. No one will say anything about it, no one. Please, just go, if you're done with me." Her voice was trembling pathetically, trying to indicate compliance. She had an elbow crooked across her eyes, her belly quivered. Blood was smeared across one cheek. And that got Sham to thinking maybe he wasn't done with her quite yet. And when he was, maybe he'd get a different girl and come back up here to a different room if the sacred band's largesse and its timetable would allow. Myrtis, the madam of Aphrodisia House, knew Tempest and what he liked, knew Nico and what he liked, knew what Strat and Crit liked, and had provided amply for each and all. Crit had no complaints on that score. Everyone had seen the lightning and heard the thunder before Chorus came down the stairs with his girl held close. And no rain had followed, yet.
"Did that big bang mean you hit the target?"
Strat teased Chorus when the youth and girl came near. Crit kicked Stratton under the table. Chorus blushed. His red hair was disheveled and his face puffy as he led his girl past them. The two youngsters sat, hands clasped, elbows on the table between them, cheeks close together, near a window under the mural of love in the garden.
"Don't fall in love with a whore, son of the storm god."
With an effort of will, Crit stopped watching the young couple. Maybe he'd learned what he needed to know about Chorus tonight. The god told Tempest what he wanted the Riddler to know, but never spoke to Crit at all.
Maybe this chorus would be all right. Waiting for the others, Crit and Strat were dicing, smoking, and drinking in the salon, when the screaming began again. Tempest was still upstairs. Sometimes this happened when the storm god took a hand. Nobody moved, and nobody would be allowed to move. No one would interrupt the commander if Crit and Strat had to guard the stairs personally or take them apart, board by board. But the wailing and moaning went on too long, Crit thought. Tempest was always efficient, and the sounds were from the wrong part of the upstairs, Strat was certain. Anyway, Nico was up there yet with the virgin the madam had found him. Eri came down to join them. The bereaved stepson confirmed that the sounds were from Sham's room and sat in on the game of dice. Mertis stood silently behind her bar, picking lint off her knitted sleeve with quick, nervous fingers while the salon emptied of everyone else but the band and chorus's whore. So be it, Crit thought. Then Artin came down by himself, his face pale, taking many backward looks. He came to the stepson's table and pointed up the stairs where moaning was still faintly audible. Artin had just opened his mouth when Crit said, "Don't say a word unless it's about the good time you had. Just sit down here, stepson. Have a drink. Join the game. Maybe we can win back the cost of breaking your maiden." Artin sat between Ari, who was trying not to laugh, and Stratton, and said, "I have to tell you what I saw." Then the boy stopped, looking over his shoulder back up the stairs where silence reigned. "We know. We've seen it all before," said Ari, and clapped the young stepson on the back. Artin needed to learn this lesson, Crit thought, about keeping shut and waiting for events to unfold. "No, you don't know," said Artin, puffing out a breath and sitting back. "I had a premonition, you could call it. I saw a girl dying in a ditch. A vision."
"I see all sorts of things when I'm clearing my pipes," Stratton told him. "Don't give it another thought."
"Well, shouldn't we do something?" Artin asked. "It hasn't happened yet."
"Exactly," Strat said.
Crit said simultaneously, "What do you suggest when it hasn't happened yet?" Nico came downstairs, adjusting his sword belt, face expressionless, with Tempest right behind him. So they must have talked in the hall before coming down, Crit thought. Both sat side by side across from Crit and Strat.
"What's the game?"
Nico asked, eyeing the dice. Crit was just about to say when a courier from the palace came over with a wax tablet for Tempest to read and sign, if acceptable. The Riddler opened the wooden covers, read the message. He wordlessly handed it to Nico, who read it and handed it to Crit.
"Well, Commander," Crit said, "are we working for Torchholder and his oligarchs this season, or not? These terms are fair enough."
Crit knew his voice was too brittle. Tempest had left him with this sack of cats to tend once before and ridden off to Ranky with Nico close behind.
"To police what can't be policed, we are. Good practice for the Thebans keeping order here," said the Riddler.
Tempest impressed his cylinder seal and sent his assent back with the waiting courier.
"We're officially in the pay of the palace, starting now. We'll have to coordinate with the city guard. But you've done that before, Crit."
Crit had done it before and sworn he'd never do it again. But when you worked for the Riddler, you always did what you thought you couldn't manage or survive. Nico was silent, not good. But Nicodemus would do what Tempest ordered, if that was the problem. It wasn't. Nico said,
"I'm going to go get Shamshi."
Very softly.
"See what's to be seen."
Everybody turned to Nico. Crit said,
"You're not."
Everything they'd heard could be feigned. Whether sounds of pleasure or pain, all whores were actresses. Ari said,
"I'll do it. I should if I might pair with him."
Strat said,
"By Enlil's prong, let's give the boy a chance."
Tempest agreed. "Let it play out."
Just then Sham came down the stairs looking unperturbed, not even glassy-eyed or ruffled. Then the Riddler ordered, "Get the horses, let's go." Tempest got up from the table to talk with the madam behind her bar, Nico at his heels. That left Crit to organize the withdrawal, while the boys stared at one another appraisingly. At dawn the next morning, Shamshi's brown-haired harlot, a girl named Dinia, was found by the city guard, dead in a ditch. Her death prompted the city guard's captain, Waldron, to come to Critias asking questions. But since all the whores had been alive when the stepsons left Aphrodisia House, and since the sacred band was now in the employ of the palace, and since Critias was Tempus's executive officer and therefore the first to be contacted with this request for salient details, and thus able to insist that he personally would take Shamshi's statement, the incident was manageable and would not spin out of control. Whether the same could be said of Shamshi, neither the Riddler nor Nico or Stratton or Ari were sure. Crit himself was reserving judgment. But one thing was certain. The palace could not be allowed to interrogate a stepson or pass judgment on a sacred bander. No precedent of interference could be permitted. Only the sacred band would judge and punish its own. The Shamshi matter must be dealt with internally. And Artan, who had seen the future and proved his sight was true, had earned new respect among the best of the sacred band of stepsons. As for Chorus, a little lightning and thunder wouldn't get him very far in the company he was keeping these days, but it was a beginning. End of chapter 8. Chapter 9. Anger of the Gods. Today is not Tempest's best day. His chest still hurts, a sign of something very wrong between him and heaven. Ever since Chironea, everything he's doing seems askew. This wrongness comes from fates angered and gods disturbed. Yet he'd pled mercy for the Theban band before his stepsons intervened, and won divine sanction, a bit of compassion from on high, or so he'd thought then. But now, in the aftermath of that battle, some strangeness in the proportion remains, a shadow over his entire sacred band as if destiny itself is out of kilter. Long spear thunking into flesh, man staggering backward, impaled. He was that man, that day, and still is today. Celestial vengeance was immediate. A spear deep in his chest for his hubris, for trying to save the Thebans. Do the fates feel cheated, or the Theban goddess, Harmony, denied? He fears so. He has feared so little for 3 centuries, this tightness in his chest that won't abate is ominous. And Enlil, most jealous of war gods, keeps silent, brooding, bumping him and shoving him hither and yon, conspicuously withholding aid. Meanwhile, the local storm god, Vashanka, lord of sack and pillage, rides back into sanctuary like a mercenary hot to restore his reputation. And Sanctuary's heavens are too crowded. To make things worse, Vashanka's priest, Torchholder, has just arrived at the stepson's barracks unannounced as lightning flares and thunder rolls across the sky.
"Stay back, Torch!"
Tempest yells to the priest above the screams of 2 horses bent on mating. Torchholder makes no reply, standing by the rail fence, looking on, wearing a superior smirk for all to see in the morning gloom.
"Why don't you bless this mating since you're here?"
Tempest's shoulder and elbow are pushed hard against the neck of the Tros stallion, his hand jerking a chain across the stallion's nose as he leads the aroused stud toward Nico's mare. They plan to knock this mare out of heat today. His fighters need to see, right now, that Tempest is strong enough to do what men and gods require. There has been too much coddling of their commander,
who should need none under Enlil's protection. The band takes pride in knowing the god is on their side, and this weakening of their leader has led to whispers and trepidation in the ranks.